now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix. Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, our very special guest is David Dunger. David Dunger has spent 32 years in the IT field. He's an IT professional, an investigator, a radio host. This is his sixth year doing his own radio podcast. He's an author, a UFO group speaker, and an Australian born in 1967. His book is about his own UFO experiences called Visitors, A Lifetime of Experiences, and it is aimed at those who question events in their own lives. David has seen a number of UFOs, been in the presence of ghosts, interviewed lots of people on and off his show. His family has a long multi-generational history in the paranormal. He lives his life in a constant search for the truth. His radio show, Shiny Side Out, is followed globally by tens of thousands of listeners. His website is www.shinysideout.net. So without any further ado, David Dunger, welcome to the show. And please, for the benefit of our listeners, please tell us how you got into this field and how you wound up doing the work you're doing.
Okay. Well, look, James, it's really weird because my whole life, I always considered there was something amiss, something really weird going on. There was a whole tangent of my life that I just kept personal to myself. There was experiences at nighttime, sightings, and a whole bunch of things. However, I was a school kid, you know, growing up, doing all the things that people do. And it wasn't until, well, let me put it this way. I've always been keenly interested in the paranormal. My mother was a medium, although we all joked while she was alive that she was a large. But she's a medium. She was a medium. And she used to have paranormal get-togethers at her house with her friends, and they called it the Circle, and they used to talk about a bunch of things. Now, I wasn't that interested in what they were talking about. Ironically, I wasn't interested at all, despite things occurring in my own life privately, that it wasn't until my mother's death that I realized it had happened to her. It wasn't until my grandmother's death prior to that that she confessed with me that she had also had a lifetime of experiences and sightings. And my mother also gave me some sage advice on her deathbed. I mean, in her deathbed, our family wouldn't talk about any of these things. And it wasn't until then that I discovered the history. No one spoke about it. It never came up as a topic. Not that I was aware of anyway. Maybe after I'd gone to bed as a kid because of things that I might have drawn at school or a plethora of other things that have occurred. Now, it wasn't until my grandmother and my mother passed away and I was still holding it within myself. I was holding all of that information within myself, and it wasn't until, I suppose, that it became not acceptable. I'm talking about visitations, that it became unacceptable for me to keep it inside when my children became involved. That was the big issue. So the moment they did, I had to write it all down. I had to get it all out, and I had to put it there out. And when I wrote it down, it left me. My problems, my fears, my doubts, the uncertainty, all of the things that people would associate with visitations or abductions, that all disappeared straight away. I no longer had any of the fear. And luckily for me, my children can't read the book. They can't read the book yet. And I will no doubt allow them at some point, or they'll just Google it and up comes my name and there you go. But the experiences that I had, each individually, didn't seem like very much. They didn't seem as though they were enough to worry about. It was an isolated incident. But when you put them all together, and that's why I'd actually remembered them all vividly, like it happened yesterday or was happening right now, And it's happened to people that I've been with as well for, you know, extended periods of time during relationships. And it only bothered me when it happened to my children. That's something I think the whole reason for writing a book was really basically just so that I could feel good in my own skin. I felt happy that I was able to relieve myself of the issues. But having said that, what changed my life and did that was children. Children was really the big key to me changing the way I looked at it, because before then I was the victim. And that being the victim is really tough. And a lot of psychologists are treating people with this like PTSD, the same thing that all the others are experiencing, they're experiencing alone. And I refused to go to groups to talk about it. I didn't want my memories confused with other people's. But I'm not saying if it's working for you, you keep doing it. That's fine with you. I had to write mine down. And my mother was a writer, and my father survived on his art. And it goes back a long way. And it was only when I discovered, when I put all the pieces together, that this thing's real. It is real. And, you know, since then I've met others who have exactly the same stories. And this is the big, that's the surprise. The surprise is that they've got the same story. It's not that it differs slightly here and there. We never met, and yet the stories are the same. Even the people in the US that I've interviewed, James, you'd be surprised. When I was lucky to interview a lady called Susan Chancellor, and she had a blog, an alien blog, that she was writing to relieve herself of the same feelings. And when I interviewed her, in those days we didn't do YouTube, and there was tears streaming down my face listening to her stories of what was happening to her. And so, it's very tough. So what am I? I'm an IT professional. That's what I am. What else do I do? What have I been seeking this whole time and doing my research is what aren't we being told about? What are we being dismissed? If we have any skills, how soon it is after you're born that those are dismissed? That's the thing that I've been researching, all the paranormal, trying to get to the bottom of it all. And we know that there is a certain amount of cover-up from a government perspective. Enough has been redacted and enough has not been redacted for us to be able to work it out, to work out where it's all going, to work out that the governments are clearly in cahoots with all of the presence, and there's probably more than one, as we've heard in the citizens' hearing on UFOs, and before then the what was the one that Stephen Greer brought out, James?
Yeah, that was at the press club in Washington D.C. The disclosure thing.
Mm-hmm. So when pre the disclosure project, which I don't think actually not many people know about it, only. But we know about it, but there's a lot of people who don't. And when you start to talk to anyone about UFOs, maybe they think you're a crackpot straight away. You know, that's the immediate thing, because they shut it down. They don't want their world affected by it. They have a belief system, and their belief system is that isn't real. Oh, they see it in Hollywood. That's enough. I don't need to know that it's real. And I know I've got friends who repeatedly tell me, Dave, you know what? I don't want to know. Don't tell me. And if the world is ending, don't tell me. I couldn't care less. I don't want that to affect my world. My world is my home, shops, and work. So the home, shops, and work triangle that people commute every day is the only thing they want to exist. They don't even care who's in government. They don't care what the geopolitics are, or exopolitics for that matter. They don't care about any of that. So when I was doing my research, and I was actually a UFO researcher when I was a child, I would take anyone's sightings, draw them up. I had a little book myself of historic, which is lost now, lost to time. and maybe, you know, 20 moves, house moves. But I was really fascinated with it. And what hooked me, besides my own experience, was the fact that people were willing to tell you one-to-one, but not in a crowd, not in a group. They didn't want to be associated with it. They didn't want other people to know. But once you told people that you were interested in that kind of thing, every once in a while someone would come up to you surreptitiously and say, "Hey, Dave, I've got a story for you. I want to tell you something later on, okay?" And you go, "Yeah, okay. I'm here if you need me." And then they would. And I'd be amazed, just absolutely amazed at how similar it was. So having said that, the way my life changed was my children. My children, it changes everybody's life. You realize for 1 second, as soon as they're born, the moment they're born, you realize, yeah, my life isn't me. My life is about them. And when I did that, it changed me completely. The people who have been involved with these sightings and the experiences myself have usually not known. One has been programmed to disagree with everything that I say or have said. If I, for instance, just look out the window and say, "Wow, what's that? That might be a UFO," pointing at nothing, making it up from scratch, and they will say, "Oh, don't worry, it's nothing." They didn't even look. Didn't even look out the window. And this is the thing that I think Bud Hopkins and the Whitley Strieber experience, in his experiences, his wife was there to, was the family calming. "Don't worry about it. It's all right. It won't, nothing's going to hurt you. It's all good." Now, that in that context, they're the person who keep it all together, the glue in the relationship. They're the person who dismiss it all. "Don't worry about it." They're trusting. And why do you trust them? Well, they're your long, you know, they're your life partner. They're looking after you. And you have to consider that they're involved as well. They don't know it, but they are. There's like the military can brainwash you into something or into a belief. I think that that's their role. I think they play that. Now, and I've found that a couple of times in my research when I'm talking to other abductees, I say, "You know, what are your family like?" And they go, "Well, they don't want to know." All right. So how do you take their disapproval of that information? Oh, it's pretty tough. And that's really hard for, I think, the people who have to suffer it alone. It's a tough world. And I know that when we went up to the experience conference, I had a chat to a number of people there, and they were all in the same boat. There were a lot of people who were just there for the curiosity. But I have to say that I found that, you know, actually one thing, everybody has a ghost story. It's an amazing thing. You say, you know what? They're completely willing to believe that ghosts could be real, or they've been frightened by the ghost, whatever it is, wherever it is. They're sometimes petrified to go back to where that thing happened. But I know that I've experienced them in two places that I've lived, one where I'm living now, one back in Surrey Hills in a house that was nearly 150 years old. And it's an extraordinary thing. Before I experienced it myself, and this is the position that the majority of people take, who can just simply deny it. Say, "You know what? Ghosts are, they can't be real. They're not real. Don't worry about it." And I say, you know what? I used to have that way of thinking. I've got a truly analytical mind. My mind is designed to see through, let's call it the glossy brochure of what's been said, and I can pinpoint the few facts that are available in that gloss and wipe away the gloss and see the real thing. And that's enabled me, I think, to get to the bottom of a lot of the good, really good, meaty stories that are out there. And, of course, we do it day to day. It's not something you switch on and switch off. And this is the thing that we do now. How many news outlets do you trust? How much news do you see every day? And now with Facebook, we're seeing news coming from even your friends. And I think people are able now to be able to communicate more on a level that feels comfortable with them on their own device, sitting on their own lounge, where you're a third party. It's them, the information, and then you. They're personally contacted with that information and they're able to share it. And I think that's been one of the biggest revelations in our current history, right up here at the tip where we're on the leading edge. Now, I said I'm techie. I'm a techo. I love tech. My house is all teched up. And yet, when I see this and I see the evolution of where we're going with this technology, I always thought, and there's a lot of jokes getting around about, you know, oh, how antisocial are we? I think we're actually communicating a lot more. We're not doing it one-to-one, face-to-face, but we are doing it, and we're doing it over greater distances, and we're striking up friendships with people that we would never have spoken to in a blue moon, and I think this is helping us. I know that if I was suffering, just taking it back to the UFO thing, if I was suffering all of my things alone and I didn't have the internet, I'd still be suffering them on my own. I would have no way of contacting anyone else. I wouldn't have known they existed. And these groups aren't highly publicized that you can go to. So unless you were actively seeking it, which I really wasn't because I was suffering alone in that PTSD thing of being abducted and being, you almost feel ashamed, you're embarrassed, you're violated. It's a whole bunch of words. They're all got negative connotations. And I know that those negative connotations were things that people had decided that was a good thing to bring out in those groups. Bring them out. Well, I didn't want to know that. I wanted to see the positive side. I want to know what was really going on. So what makes it really going on? Well, I'll tell you, in my case, I went to a skin specialist. This is a good story. You'll like this one. I went to a skin specialist because I'd lost, let's call it a silver dollar-sized piece of hair from my scalp. It just disappeared. And I was wondering, where did it go? It wasn't in a shower. It wasn't on my pillow. You know, wake up in the morning, have a shower, wash your hair. Hang on, that's just like that's a bald, round piece. I showed my partner. She goes, there's no hair there at all. So I booked myself in. You'll love this one. I booked myself in to see a skin specialist. And he put it looks like a microscope, but it's smaller, right up against the skin on my head in that bare patch, which was just behind my right ear. And he said, you've never had hair there. I said, no, that's not, it was just like a week ago, because it takes like a week to see a specialist. So you see your doctor, they give you a referral, then you ring them and you book it, an appointment, then you have to go like to the eastern suburbs it was. And this guy was near retirement too, and he'd seen everything. We were laughing and joking about all the really crazy things that people have come in with, but he didn't say who they were. He was just talking about the medical side of it, and I really enjoy that. So he's having a look, and he said, there's no hair follicles. And I couldn't believe it. And he said, well, what happened? I said, I don't know. I went to sleep one morning, woke up the next morning. Sorry, sleep one night, wake up the next morning, and there was hair missing. So that worried me. And he said, well, is there anything else? And I said, well, I've got this lump under my skin. Maybe you can have a look to see what it is. This is the height of the skin cancer epidemic, the breakout of the media telling us that we're going to die of skin cancer if we don't get everything checked out. So I was quite worried. I said, well, I'll have a look at this thing. And he said, oh, look, who knows what it is, but, you know, we'll cut it open and maybe take a biopsy or take a sample of it and see what it is. And I can't see what he's doing. And he's sort of standing behind me to the left. And he has this sucking machine. I've got to hold this sucking machine there to get all the blood because, gee, it was profuse. There was blood coming out everywhere. It was miles of it. And he said, before he started this procedure, he said to his assistant outside, the receptionist, look, hold all my calls. I don't want to be disturbed. I'm going to do some surgery on this fellow. And he pounded me with needle anesthetic there. And to fix the hair bit, just taking it back to that, he put 50 injections of steroids into that location on my head.
Uh-huh.
50 of them. That's bleeding profusely from all of the needles. Oh, now we're big needles too. Big. And I'm not afraid of these things, but I just think it was funny. So he's got me holding onto this suction thing. It's like the dentist one, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's got that. I'm holding that, and he's cutting me open. And then his desk phone rings. And we're laughing. We're joking. We're having a really, really cool time. This kind of time that you have, you know, if you're, you know, how can I put it? He was open. He was open. There was a good feeling in the room where he's laughing. And he said, oh, you'd never believe this. Lady came in. Oh, she took a shoe off. I nearly died. The smell was so bad. I had to look at this skin thing that she had on the base of her foot. It was eating her skin away. And I go, wow. And I'm amazed. And he's delighted in telling the story. His phone rings. He trundles over, picks the phone up and says, hello. Now, I'm recalling in my head where he asked his receptionist to hold all calls.
Yes.
That's been violated now. That is no longer on the books. He's picked the phone up. As soon as he said hello, there's a 3-second gap, and he pivots on his heels and he looks directly at me. I'd wager $20 that conversation was about me.
Yeah, most likely.
Absolutely. And so he said, uh-huh, right, and he hung up the phone. When he returned to me, his demeanor was completely different. He was closed. He didn't laugh. He didn't joke. He didn't speak. And just before the phone rang, he'd got the scalpel to what I would say was a metal object in my arm. And right at that point is when the phone rang. So he gets back to me and I said, well, how are we going to do with this thing? And he goes, you'll be right. And he starts stitching me up. He left the thing in the arm, started stitching me up. And I couldn't believe it. And I said, well, what is it? Am I going to be okay, doctor? You'll be right. And he sent me home. And that was the last contact I had with that skin specialist. Now, since then, I've spoken to some radiologists, some people who perform x-rays and scans on people. And these are in public hospitals that I've spoken to these people, because I've been in, I've had broken toes and a broken foot. And I've gone in for x-rays, and while they're doing it, you know, they led me up and took the x-rays. And I say, you know what, guess I got a question. I hope you don't mind me asking, but I'm going to ask you a question. And that is, how many weird things have you seen in the x-rays? And they go, what on earth do you mean? I said, well, things that maybe shouldn't be there. And we all know that we can all laugh and joke about there being like this hospital reel of, I don't want to make it rude, but like insertions. And I'm not talking about those. I'm talking about things under the skin. And they say, we find them all the time. We're not allowed to let you see them, so we delete them. And the best evidence of that was I had a full x-ray of my body from like a PET scanning machine, not PET, one that came from a vet.
Uh-huh.
Right? And this lady, she x-rayed me, and she, you know, in those days, they could do the emulsion immediately after it. It took, you know, 15 minutes, and they exposed the film and did whatever it is they do. And she came back, and she's pointing out my spine, and I'm looking at this thumbprint, which isn't in a position where if you were holding the x-ray, that's where your thumb could reach. It was beyond that. And I go, what's that? What's that? What's that mark there? She goes, oh, that's my thumbprint. Oh, okay. I thought to myself, well, maybe it is a thumbprint. So she goes, look, this isn't, I need some more x-rays of you. So can you stand on your side and you can face the front and do all these things? So she does, and she takes them and comes back. And there's the thumbprint again in the same spot. and she'd adjusted it. So it wasn't like it was where you had to hold it when it was going through the machine, or where you plucked it out of the emulsion, whatever it was, not in the same spot relative to where that was, because the machine had been moved. And yet there is that spot. There's the spot she's covered up, and they're taught to smudge it. Get rid of it. We don't want to see it. That's in the olden days. Now digitally they can just delete it. So that was one of those turning pivotal moments that I was really began to focus in on what was happening and who knew. Today is a completely different story. So, James, if I was to tell you today, if we were to have a conversation about this, I would say I'm absolutely positive the government knows everything that's going on. In fact, I'd be even more positive to suggest that the people who have had experiences are also being tracked by the government in some way. Because wouldn't you, if you were the government, if you'd made an agreement with whether they're extraterrestrial or not, let's just call them visitors. So the visitors might be living in the Antarctic. I don't really know. They might have always been here. They might be the zookeepers. Who knows? So, and that's what I don't have the answer. I wish I knew all the answers, but I'm positive that if I was the government and I'd signed an agreement that's, you know what, you can abduct whoever you want, I don't care, but we need some tech. I would like to negotiate tech from you. Doesn't that seem fair? Oh, we can't intervene. Well, we're not asking you to intervene, would be the conversation. We're not allowed to give you technology. How about we help you develop it? Sure, let's do that. Righto. So what are you going to be doing with these people? Says the government to the visitor. Oh, nothing. Don't worry about it. It's all good. We can't really tell you. And this is the way I imagine the conversation would have gone. And they've gone, okay, as soon as the visitor left, they've gone, how do we track them? How do we know what's going on? So with reams of names, lists of names that the government might have received, I don't know how that works. Maybe the high-tech surveillance that they've put in is designed to be able to trace where they go. I'd put $50 on that they know about it, that they're tracking it, and the governments are completely aware of it, and globally they're aware of it. That's the way that I look at it.
Yeah, that's how I feel about it. And I've spoken to enough people that have had similar medical anomalies, let's say. Like one guy that comes to mind, he was a former CIA paramilitary, many years in law enforcement. He showed me his x-rays, and he had at least 6 implants in different places. And I knew he'd had ET experiences. So his time working for the CIA and in law enforcement, somewhere along the line, they must have known he was having these experiences. And I've spoken to other people who'd had their medical records mysteriously disappear. And and still others who are Rh negative blood, who keep having their blood samples disappear and are continually asked to provide more Rh negative blood. So there are a lot of medical anomalies when it comes to people like us.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm Rh negative. And that was as soon as I read some of that on the internet, when the internet was first, when I first got to the internet around about 96, I was surprised to see the connection with abductees and Rh negative. I just thought that was an extraordinary thing. And then to know that you're in that group, and then it all seems to make sense. Wow. I'll tell you what my grandmother saw. She told me a story when I was a kid, and it didn't seem to mean very much to me at the time, but it certainly does now, and it's important, I think, to share it. So I'll share it. She said that, I mean, she lived on a farm that didn't have town power, gas, or water, or sewage. It was just a farm sort of nearer Barrington Tops. If you want to Google it, you'll have a look. It's pretty isolated. It's on the coastline, though, but up in the mountains. And, you know, she would only maybe need to go to the store every quarter or every month or two or something like that. She told me that she didn't need to go very often at all, that they were pretty much self-sufficient on the farm. And I thought, oh, that's pretty good. And she said she was, well, she said she was in the kitchen looking out the window, so that would usually mean that she would have either been having a cup of tea or doing the dishes or something like that. She was might have been washing up. And she looked out the window into the garden, and the garden comprised of some, you know, roses and citrus, but then next to it was the food crop, and that would have been tomatoes and beans and all the things you would want to grow yourself. And she said that there was a ball of light that didn't appear to have a hard surface, although the deeper you got towards the middle, the more bright it was, and it could very well have been solid, but this glow was like a basketball shape of glow around a smaller object. And she said it was dancing around the flowers, like fluttering around like a butterfly. It seemed random, though purposefully driven. And she was looking at it and observing it for a short while before she actually said in her own mind, "Isn't that wonderful?" So there's a difference. I'm cutting a distinction here between just purely watching something without any thoughts in your head and actually having a thought in your head. What she's done, apparently, because she said at the moment she said that to herself, it stopped dancing about carefree and careless amongst the flowering plants and then disappeared out of view. Huh. And she crooked her neck to see if it would just gone to the left or right. I don't remember which direction it went in. And the story is a bit vague, and I was very young. But she said it disappeared, and she couldn't see it. So she continued on doing what she was doing, thinking, well, wasn't that a lovely experience? And then she had the feeling that as though something was watching her, so she turned around, and it was in the kitchen with her. She said to get in there, it would have had to have come in the front door, and in those days you could leave the front and back door open. But it's come in the front door, negotiated around furniture through doorways and different rooms to get to where she was, and confronted her in the kitchen. She said she immediately backed up against the cabinetry, and she said there was an exchange of thoughts. She knew more after that experience or during it than before she had the experience. She said it wasn't awful. She wasn't threatened at all. She didn't feel threatened, although she felt scared. And then it left out the back door, never to be seen again. It must have been piloted in a way that made it intelligently controlled. When she brought this up at her local UFO group, because she was in a local UFO group, my grandmother, good on her, they said to her, and experts that she talked to, and she had some interesting connections with people and business people. And, you know, like not science types, but people who believed they were science-y in those days. Visionary types. And she said, look, what do you think it was? And she described the story to them. And they said, ball lightning. That's what it is, ball lightning. Nothing more, nothing less. And yeah. So she sort of felt like comfortable. We've named it something. I don't have to worry about it anymore. But she held on to that thought until the deathbed, and then she told me. And I think that's really important. Then having, as an adult, having read the Foo Fighter descriptions of the white balls of what looked like light emanating plasma balls or something that the pilots have seen and had bizarre experiences with, flight crews in modern aircraft were warned about these things, that they may appear on your flight. Don't worry about them in their training. They're told they may just cruise down the middle of the aisle and just disappear out the back wall. No harm will, come to anyone. Don't worry about it. It's going to be just fine. And this is the kind of thing, once you start to piece it together, they're real. They are real. They're still real. They were real then as they are now. But the question comes up, what are they or who are they? What is it? Is it a technical device? Is it like a probe? You know, I couldn't imagine that we could land on any planet, to be honest, and start breathing its air if we weren't, you know, if we don't have a DNA history on the planet. We could die instantly from some mega virus on there that we've never encountered before. You know, we have smallpox doesn't affect us very much now because we've been through it. But, you know, this is what the Indians and the native South Americans discovered, that that can ravage you. So imagine if we've never been to a planet before and we step off the planet, that it could be quite dangerous to us. Could be all sorts of viruses we've never encountered. Let's call them alien for a minute. And they would be, that would be the detriment of our exploration, even visiting Mars. Yeah, unless we've actually got a genetic history there, which I think we probably do, then there's an issue straight away. So having said that, that's why I ask, what is it? Who was it? It's intelligently controlled. Was it a probe? Was it a probe? That's what we would do. We would send probes out to do what we need to do. And right now we could just have a VR goggles on or whatever, and we could remotely control something. And but she said, and her words still echo, we had an exchange. There was an exchange. It could hear my thoughts. So that makes it sentient. So you have a sentient thing floating around in the yard that was telepathic. That changes everything. You know that little skeleton that Stephen Greer?
Yes.
Imagine if that was flying in something, like a little light ship flying around, and the rest of it was just not cloaking technology, but like a force field or something, or maybe the light is the way it is, or maybe it's a light being. I don't know, but it's definitely something, and it's something that raises more. The problem is, James, you find this out too, right? The more you seem to know, the more questions you have.
Yes, absolutely.
Because you're not given the whole answer. I mean, the whole answer isn't just delivered to you on the doorstep and you go, oh, okay, there's the answer. That's not it. That's not how it works. So having found out, having that, and that's a really good example. My arm was a good example, and I'll tell you there's another lump on there that's since that one was ruined during that the thing, I have another one on the outside of my arm now, same left arm. And James, you'll love this. There was a, and I hope the listeners do too, there was a really interesting case where a farmer that farmed in the US on one side of a hill, on the other side was a river in a deep gorge. And he said to his wife and kids, I'm going up there to check the fences because his cattle would get out or you know, they just had to make sure the right gates were closed, or maybe he was going to move some of his stock from one pen to another, or who knows, the grazing stock. So he goes up the mountain on a quad bike, doesn't return. His quad bike is later found. It's found with the clothes neatly folded. Now, neatly folded from an investigative point of view usually means a suicide. Sadly to say, that's people who are going to jump off a bridge will, you know, take their shoes off and fold their socks and make them perfectly neat where at their point of launching off the bridge. Did you know that, James?
No, I didn't.
Yeah. So from a profiling point of view, when you see that, you know, shoes nicely, neatly folded, you know, maybe a jacket folded. Why fold it? Just leap off.
I know.
You know, right? But they didn't. And so this guy, all was found, they didn't find a body or anything, and they found just a quad bike with his clothes all folded up. And I thought it was extraordinary. However, a parallel story was being told to the police about a week later when the fishermen on the other side of the mountain, on the other side, saw a craft and a beam of light and a guy got taken up into it. Now, MUFON didn't get both stories. They just got the one story they've registered. I think you can still find it on their website as a case study. Now, the police were baffled. They combed the whole thing. They had volunteers and everything, couldn't find anyone. And then later, they found the remains. A naked man with a crushed upper left arm, crushed by what looked like, you know, maybe the jaws of life, you know, like a crushing mechanism, metallic thing would have had to have done it. Nothing else, no bears, no wildlife could have done it at all. His quad bike was in perfect condition. He hadn't rolled it or done anything. It didn't look like he's fallen into anything. Why was he naked? Don't know. And what was the damage to his upper left arm? And they said that it looked like he was being, this is the fisherman, looked like it had, this guy had been grabbed by something and taken up. So these two stories merged together into a single event. Now, of course, the family had to feel for him because the guy didn't survive the whatever happened to him. It's like the human mutilation rather than the cattle mutilation.
Yes.
Mekki and I, Mekki's my co-host on Shiny Side Out, if you don't know. And we were both independently researching things, and when we met up at a company we work for, a global company, 90,000 at the time, 90,000 employees, really big company. And they were into technology and research themselves. And by the way, when you work for that company, you sign away your inventions. If you invent anything during your employment with that company, whether at work or not, the company owns it.
Huh.
So, and I'll tell you that they had rather large military contracts. So though that's the reason for it. They were willing to innovate anything they could. So Mekki and I met up at that company and immediately hit it off, and from then on we've been friends. And it's funny, I'll tell you a funny story. When we get together, it is like we're a television show. We're talking at a party. Other people will crowd around and listen to us talk. We're just talking. This is what happened before we got a radio show. And so we'd be talking, and you look, you know, suddenly you're captivated by the conversation, and then at some point you'll look around and discover there's tons of people in the party all standing around listening. And we think that that's a good thing, that people are listening to our point of view, because we wouldn't normally talk about it. However, and we're talking about conspiracies, we're talking about aliens, we're talking about all the things that people talk about today. We were doing this, you know, 20 years ago. That's great, right? It hasn't changed us. We know more now because of our research, but then we had more questions. Now we have even more questions and we know a lot more. And what we found was the people that were standing around listening to it, listening to us talking, would be going home in the car having switched that part of their brain off, and they don't want to know anymore. When we talk to them later on, they go, oh, that was really entertaining. You go, what was entertaining? Oh, that thing you were doing. You were talking about what were those things, you know, the conspiracies. Well, you know, it's a conspiracy theory. Maybe it's fact. The conspiracy theory term was made up by the CIA, right? So we're just researchers. That's all we do. And so people would be entertained by us. Entertained. What? Not, it wasn't an ed, they weren't being educated because they didn't care. And this is the really big thing. Now, what we found when talking about this kind of, these kind of topics that we're talking about, whether it's, you know, the ghosts, paranormal, you know, whether you're talking about, you know, deep state or governments or black, you know, black projects, or, you know, the money the Pentagon doesn't have or lost, you know, any of the conspiracies that are out there, sorry, I should say, any of the events out there where the narrative doesn't match the event, let's put it that way. You can throw them off. If I run into anyone brand new and I say, oh, I've got a radio show, and I go, oh, yeah, really? Cool. What music do you play? And, oh, we don't play music, we talk. Oh, what do you talk about? Conspiracies. And they go, the first one is, tell me about the moon landing, JFK, and 9/11. So what we've been doing is talking about other topics. We've talked about those ones to the end of the conversation because there's no new evidence, but we've formulated ideas. But I think that's really extraordinary. But the younger the audience now, you find people in their 20s, and they're already across it. YouTube. YouTube is the miracle worker in all of this. Without that, they had only the corporate-funded documentaries that would ever get aired on television. Now, let's call them citizen reporters. Citizen reporters are taking, you know, images on their smartphones and sending them out, putting them up on social media, and the social media has been the biggest blessing we could ever have wanted, because it's getting the news out. Yeah, you still have to do the same thing that you would do in all the normal media outlets, and that is question the narrative. Always do that. Never, if all you do is question it, good for you. If you take it on board at face value from the, you know, the big players in the media, you know, they're all owned by the same company or the same people. They're all controlled by those. They're the controlled media. So you've got to be careful to make your choices. Do your research. If you want to listen to it and take it on as being fact, good for you. I'm not going to argue with you. I'll just say, for instance, JFK, single bullet, magic bullet, impossible. The court case which derived the answer of the magic bullet, that was preposterous. It should have kept running until they found the real answer, but they whitewashed it and stopped it before it could come to its rightful conclusion. Doesn't make sense. Why would they do that? I don't know. I don't know why. I know they did. When you talk about 9/11, Building 7, you only have to look at Building 7. And you tell me more about that, right? So that's what people do. And the young people now have a really good concept. They've seen all the videos. They don't have to believe them all, but at least they've seen them. But they ask me, I'll tell you, James, they ask me, they go, Dave, can you tell me what really happened at 9/11? I said, well, you can have a look at our YouTube if you like. No, just tell me. I haven't got time. Just tell me now. And I'll give them the facts, only the facts that will allow them to make their decision. And I say, you go away and watch the videos, then you come back, and then you tell me what your thoughts are now. And that's the most important thing, is to educate people to feed themselves. But where does that all leave us? I've had to step back from what we research now. Some things you don't want to know. Even us. And you can't worry about it. Because I remember there was some meteors coming in. There was some asteroids. Some comets and asteroids going to hit the planet. People, oh, it's the end of the world. Really, is it? Oh, 2012, the end of the world. No. It's just going to keep going. I'm not saying we were right in calling it the right way, but don't let the doomsday component of it ruin you. Do you know what? The best education I ever had was watching a NASA documentary on spaceflight. And there's a whole other story in that, but I'll tell you that as soon as you have a plan with actions in it for a particular scenario, you don't have to be nervous or scared of it occurring because you've got a plan. It's the same thing as you're not panicked to find out your house may be on fire at some point in the future. You know, it doesn't worry you. If you want it to worry you, go ahead. Let yourself feel that. But then if you make a plan to say, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get to the floor, crawl to the exit, escape. If you have family, I'll get them and escape with them. If they have the same plan as you to get low and go, 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 I think that was the catch phrase from that, then they're saved. So your plan eliminates fear. You know what to do when the time comes. You just go and do it. Now, this is the problem with telling people too much information is that they don't have the ability to process it. They didn't go through the steps you went through from, you know, step one through to step 20 or whatever it was, all the things you've had to find out to get to there, because that's the logical conclusion of it. You just told them the answer. It's like picking up a good book. You imagine standing next to someone in a bookseller and you say, oh, you know, the butler did it. They're going to hate you. Right? Don't do that. Give them the breadcrumbs that led you to where you went and how you got there. And that's why I say Building 7, the magic bullet's impossible. There's too many things with the JFK one. And the moon landing, I just love that. That is great. That is so good. There's so many different aspects to that that has surprised me. But the one that really gets me is why we've never returned. So if you think about who actually went, what footage there was, and I know NASA released it like 10,000 frames of footage. When you go through all of those steps and you find duplicate scenes from two missions on the same hill that appear on the log to be different locations, that doesn't make sense.
Yes.
All right. So there's one with their vehicle and on a hill, and then there's one where they're just picking up rocks, same hill, same camera angle, but the vehicle wasn't on that moon mission, and yet it was touted as being on two different moon missions. So what were they doing and why were they filming it the way they did? Is the film real? Probably not now when you look at the evidence. Maybe the later mission, but when you see, and I've actually met Buzz, believe it or not, I've met Buzz, and I asked him about aliens and he refused to answer the question, but I was a kid and he was at a shopping center and the last thing he wanted to do was tell me, a kid at a shopping center, when he was, you know, contracted to sign autographs. He didn't want to tell me anything. And I really wanted to know, James. I wanted to know so bad. But as a kid, I was asking the questions. Even then, I didn't believe it. So I think in the 70s, it was discovered that the Apollo 11 was only ever in low Earth orbit. So it was revealed, of course, that the moon mission – Apollo 11 may not have been filmed where they said it was filmed, i.e. on the moon. So I don't ask any more questions other than what were they trying not to reveal? So were they so paranoid that their equipment couldn't get to the moon because, well, it's the moon, it's too far away, Van Allen belt, all of the things that people mention? Was it that? Do they just want to win? Because that was up there as well. The winning part. We can show those Russians. We'll show them. Who knows? I'm not there, and I've not spoken to anyone personally about what their impressions are about the race to the moon as opposed to bringing something out in the media that looks like they went there. Now, maybe they really did go there. Maybe. But they hid it all because they were afraid of what they would reveal on camera that was there. I remember seeing one quote, I think it was 12 or 14, Apollo 12 or 14, where they said that they keep standing the mirrors up and they keep knocking them over.
Hmm.
Have you heard that quote, James?
I think so, yeah.
Now, isn't that a revelation? Who's knocking them over? I thought there was only two dudes there in a capsule in a lunar lander. So unless they've got space madness and they're sabotaging it themselves, there's something else there. And then that lends itself, when you hear the word they in that quote, it makes you wonder why we haven't been back. And then you hear quotes from ex-astronauts saying they wouldn't let us go back again. So doesn't it? It just raises more. And that's why I'm so curious. I'm so curious to know, to actually know the truth. Now, I've seen people on the internet going about it the wrong way. They go about it all the wrong way. They hunt down the astronauts, and you know, if you've seen a guy put the Bible out, so they get, you know, put your hand on the Bible.
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah, and tell me you went to the moon, and then they get all violent on them. The astronaut refuses to answer the question. Why would you do that? Why? I mean, that was a very aggressive stance from the interviewer's point of view, and I think he made a tremendous point. But there was the best one, the best quote for the moon ever was actually about Mars. And I love this. And the quote was, and I think you'll be able to find this if you Google it. Neil and Buzz wanted to return to Mars. They've always wanted to return to Mars, was the quote. Now, this was a former astronaut. He was being interviewed, I think, on Fox, and he made the same slip up twice. Twice, not once. Once is a slip up, right? But repeating it again, oh my goodness, that says a whole bunch.
That means it's embedded in his consciousness. He can't get it out of his head.
Well, it must have been the truth then. I thought maybe it's just a Freudian slip. But, you know, in the history books, has it ever got Neil and Buzz going to Mars in the first place? I mean, they have to have done that to be able to return to it. So maybe the Apollo mission wasn't about that at all. Maybe there was a secret space program that went beyond what the public one was. So today, the question still remains and has been thwarted, I think, by NASA's own people. And that is, could we send people to the moon or Mars? And in every statement that you can see from NASA, they all say, well, we can't, you know, the payload is pretty heavy to get there and to, you know, and bring them back again. So we're limited by the amount of shielding we can put on the craft. And we're not going to be sending anyone to Mars until we can shield it enough from the Van Allen belt radiation. You what? We're not putting anyone into space until we can do that. So you'll notice that space travel for humans has only been low Earth orbit. Maybe they discovered that really early on. Maybe they refused to do it. Remember Capricorn 1, James, the movie?
Oh, yes.
That was meant to be. That's in the movie, it's about Mars. There's a connection. But the movie was supposed to be the revelation to everyone that they never did go at all. The whole thing was filmed in a studio, and it was just to save face. I'm not saying that this is what happened in real life. That's what happened in the movie. But when you start to join the dots and you see, well, there's a few things. If you're looking for your own research on the moon, the waving flag, it's not waving flag. It's just being turned into the soil. It doesn't wave of its own account once they let go of it. But the strings holding the people up and the odd way of being able to right yourself and some of the movement of the rover, their lunar rover, doesn't seem quite right. It just doesn't. And when you speed up the film twice as fast, it just looks like they're on Earth. So I'm not saying no, they didn't go, because I know there's equipment up there that's reflecting lasers back. So they must have gone there at some point to put the reflectors up so we could point a laser at the moon and see how far away from Earth it is. That's how you can measure it. And it is there and it is real. And that's so I can't say definitively we didn't go, but I just think there's a whole Saturn rocket they never launched in Florida at the Space Museum. It's been dismantled. So how many did they actually build? How many did they build? How many went? What did they see on the moon? And I love this question because I'm a big believer in there being a civilization in the solar system before humans. Meki and I, from our radio show standpoint and personally, we believe that this isn't the first technological civilization on the planet. Maybe ours has done it a few times as humans, but the interesting point here is that NASA commissioned a group of people, scientists, to discover, to estimate in their report back, what would dinosaurs look like?
Yes.
Have you seen
the Dale Russell study?
Yes.
Yes.
And that would be if they had turned into bipedal species. So they, as a human form. And I think there was something like 20 steps from a rodent to a human, but there was 4 or 5 steps from a velociraptor into a human shape, form. And they wanted to know what the skin would look like, what the eyes would be like, what color they'd be. Wow. So NASA spent millions on this investigation.
Yes, and then they tried to discredit their own findings because Dale Russell, I think he was a paleontologist, he came under a lot of harassment, quite frankly, because they did a scale model of what this being would have looked like. I think they took a truodon, was a upright bipedal, had a tail, opposing thumb, larger brain to body mass ratio than a lot of other dinosaurs. And then they did a forward projection evolution-wise. What would this being look like if it survived the cataclysm that took out the rest of the dinosaurs? What would it look like today? And then they unveiled this scale model.
That's right.
Of a being that looks like an alien, basically. It looks like a reptilian alien.
And I have to say, how spot on was that image?
Yes, it was quite... It was quite accurate as far as a particular type of reptilian alien looks like. And mm-hmm. so that was a study commissioned by a NASA consultant, too. So that was interesting. And that was some 20-odd years ago by now.
It's funny what you remember, isn't it?
Yeah.
So given what we've currently talked about, so far, because I'm just going all over the shop. Stop me and make me pull me up on something if you want to know more. But and I know you know a lot of this, and I think it's really important information. One of the things that I wanted to bring up, of course, was the Brookings Report.
Oh yes,
it was commissioned in 1960 by what was then the joint. Was it NACA?
National Aeronautics. It was a predecessor for NASA, I think it was.
Yeah, that's right. The NACA, yeah. And the Air Force, or was it the Navy? I can't remember which one it was at the time. But they held on to it for a year, and it was tabled in 1961 to the House Committee of Science, if it serves me right, if my mind serves me right there. And the whole report had a lot of information in it, but the pertinent parts, if you can get a copy of the Brookings Report, anywhere between 102, pages 102 and 105 and 183 and 184 are the most important parts to that, because they talk about what they should do, what should we do, and what would the effects be of disclosing alien contact with the American people. And, of course, their estimated findings then were that, you know, civilization would come to a halt, no one would go to work anymore, the economy would collapse, and to the detriment of the government and the ruling parties, the whole thing would dissolve. Pandemonium would occur because people weren't ready. And I think since then, since 1961, I think, you know, I was born in 67, and it's an extraordinary thing today that we don't think the same way. And yet the report and its commission report still uphold that same level of non-disclosure. But I think we're getting somewhere. We're finding planets. But the dismissal of UFOs and aliens is almost treated like it's a joke. They don't really consider you as a person. They consider the people as being stupid, but a person is intelligent. Now, we've been educated nonstop since then. Think about all the sci-fis. Think about all of the books, all of the movies. You know, every alien species, except for, I think, one of them, or is it two of them, want to blow up the Earth or kill everyone. Only E.T., the movie, the friendly alien. Oh, and the other one was Paul. Only those two movies consider aliens as, you know, non-threatening. All the other ones were threatening and almost putting us into a position where we cry out for a world government.
Yes. All and I think also, just to make a point and get back to the whole moon landing thing, I think the moon landing, whether it happened or not, and I have reasons to believe that it didn't happen as we were told it happened, I believe they got there. They just didn't get there the way they told us. But
yeah.
The point being is that when the news crews went around the world in the wake of the quote-unquote moon landing, and they were going to villages in Africa, and they were asking children what they thought about it, right? Mm-hmm. Now, when I saw the film of all this, it twigged on me what this was all about. We're just a global village. We're all just one people. We all come under the banner of humanity. We're all one world, one people, one world government. And so that's what, to me, the meaning behind one of the purposes of the moon landing was to plant this meme into mass consciousness of one humanity under one hegemony, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, the thought that we didn't go, or that we did go, and the reasoning behind whichever the motive happens to be, the reason behind it, still has me scratching my head. Because I think about, my thoughts are, and I think I speak for a lot of people who suggest the same thing to me, who aren't in the same position that I'm in. They haven't gone through the research, and they question it and arrive at an answer. Look, sure, we didn't go. Why not? Maybe because we needed to go and they faked it. Who knows? And I say, well, what would you say if I said to you that there might very well be structures on the moon, that it may very well be hollow, that there are structures on Mars and other places, and the obelisk, there's also an obelisk on the moon of Mars as well. What would you say if I told you that? Oh, then they wouldn't film it and reveal it to the people then, would they? I said, no, they wouldn't.
No, they wouldn't. Hold that thought. We got so much more to cover in the second hour. Mm-hmm. For the benefit of the listeners, could you let them know what your website is and how they can get a hold of you?
Oh, absolutely. The radio show is Shiny Side Out, so we have a website, shinysideout.net. But if you're interested where our show, you can find out everything there, and all our archives and all our show notes are there as well, so you might be interested in that. But it's the email address, if you're interested in emailing me, just offhand, is dave@shinysideout.net. And if you're wondering where the Shiny Side Out part comes from, it's from the correct folding of your tinfoil hat.
I like that.
But I have to put a disclaimer. Do not wear a tinfoil hat and use your cell phone. It is damaging to your pineal gland.
No doubt.
Because it's a focal point. Because your head's a sphere. You're going to cover half of it. So now you've got a parabolic curve over your head. Any radio signal is going to bounce off that, and the very center focal point of that is your pineal gland. So please don't use a cell phone when you have a tinfoil hat on. Yes, so that's our contact details. There's also a book, and I want to talk about that in the second hour, but my book is interesting. Remember, I've actually written that to get it out of me, and the people who have been reading it are people who have also had very similar experiences and have been able to relate. And some of their stories are amazing. And they've emailed me lovely people have emailed me with some of the things that they've said. You know, actually, the same thing happened to me. It's almost like you're reading my life. And this is the same tale of all the other abductees as well.
And that's the value of the book, Visitors, A Lifetime of Experiences. David Dunger is the author, and David Dunger is our guest. This is James Bartley. You've been listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. If you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to our website, thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member, and we've got a lot more to go with David in the second hour, and we'll see you at the top of the next hour.